Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
The House is back. MPs have returned to the House of Commons to begin the first parliamentary session under the new Liberal government. The Grits have now laid out their plan in the speech from the throne, which was delivered with few surprises. We break down the Liberal blueprint with the McLean's panel, and we have a reaction from former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien.
One of the commitments from this government is to bring a new tone to the House of Commons. To speak more about the state of parliamentary affairs and how the Liberals plan to run government differently, we're joined by government House Leader Dominic LeBlanc.
Canada remains locked in climate talks in Paris at the COP21 conference, but are we actually getting anywhere with our international partners? McLean senior writer Laura Payton was in Paris covering the conference and is here to discuss the roadblocks ahead.
And the House of Commons has a new speaker. Liberal MP Jeff Regan has been elected to take over as the referee of MPs. To speak about the challenges he may face in the role, we speak with outgoing speaker Andrew Scheer.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
Welcome to the 42nd Parliament of Canada.
And with that, the new Trudeau era began. Just 6 weeks after the historic October election, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau joined rookie and veteran MPs as they packed the House of Commons to kickstart the first parliamentary session under this Liberal majority government.
Of course, the big moment came on Friday when the Governor General laid out the Liberal agenda in the speech from the throne. The speech itself was brief and low-key. The highlights are essentially a recap of the Liberal campaign.
The government will, as an immediate priority, deliver a tax cut for the middle class. The government will make significant new investments in public transit, green infrastructure, and social infrastructure. The government will continue to provide leadership as Canada works toward putting a price on carbon. Internationally, the government will focus its development assistance on helping the world's poorest and most vulnerable, and will continue to work with its allies in the fight against terrorism.
It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Associate Editor for McLean's, Aaron Wherry, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for being here, guys.
Good to be here.
Luckily enough, the Liberals actually broke down their throne speech into five main themes and sections.
It's very convenient.
We can work it all out piece by piece. So let's start it off, John, then, with growth for the middle class. It was the first priority for this Liberal government. Is that achievable? Can you actually grow the middle class in this environment?
It's very interesting. You know, we had new numbers up from StatsCan just a few days ago. It's true that we're out of a recession, but you know, people are looking at best 2% growth in 2016, the first full year of this new government. That's not strong growth. There's just no way that in that tepid growth climate, people are going to feel like things are buoyant. So the Liberals are counting on things other than actual economic growth. They're counting on a tax cut for the middle class feeling like something good. I don't think it will. The tax cut is quite small, $50, $100 for a lot of families. It won't feel like that much. The silver lining for them could be the Canada Child Benefit. For parents, that is substantial money and a substantial streamlining and simplification system. So I think if they've got a part of that first part of their agenda that I think could really work, I think that's it.
Aaron, are you as pessimistic about the growth plan?
I don't know. It's tough to say. The John's right that the tax cut doesn't seem like a major element here. But what's interesting to me about this section is all of the parts of it that we haven't really talked about and haven't really focused on in the last few months. You know, they're talking not only about infrastructure, which has been heavily covered, but, you know, pension reform, employment insurance reform, post-secondary education assistance, a new health accord with the provinces. These are major elements of an agenda, and I think it's indicative of the fact that of how much there could be over the next 4 years.
All right, now the next section is being a more open and transparent government. Aaron, you've been looking into this. What are some of the major planks out of this section?
The big thing for me is this commitment again to make sure that this year's election was the last federal election under the first past the post system. I don't know if we quite grasp how big and dramatic a debate this could be. In the context of looking at governments that have tried to do big things, there was Pearson's government that in 5 years did a lot of major things, but it also gave us a new national flag. And that was a long, torturous debate because it went to something so central, I guess, to national identity and how things work. And I wonder whether this is going to be Trudeau's version of the national flag debate. Maybe not as long, but opinions are so divided that I really wonder how they're going to get through that cleanly and easily.
I think Aaron's right. Colonel, could I just add to that? And people will already remember this in lots of parts of the country. Ontario, BC, PEI, and the UK have all had plebiscites on getting rid of first past the post every time it's been rejected. The liberal assumption that this can become a popular thing or a thing that people just acquiesce to, I think that's wishful thinking.
So I wanted to shift gears to the next topic that the Liberals identify in their five themes for this throne speech. It's the environment and the economy. Of course, both of those issues have been a big focus for the government as it tries to deal with the provinces, especially on environmental issues. John, what's your take on this?
It's pretty much what they promised in the campaign, although maybe this is just nuance, but in the throne speech, they talk about putting a price on carbon and reducing carbon pollution. What they don't mention is setting a national target. In their campaign platform, they talked about setting a national target for these reductions. That may sound like quibbling, but I think national target is stronger language than putting a price on carbon, reducing carbon pollution. Trudeau has to sit down with the premiers within the next 3 months and come up, hammer a deal on this. I wonder if they're just edging back a little bit from how clearly they're going to be on that commitment.
All right, now on diversity in the Canadian social fabric, one of the big focuses for this government is trying to repair the relationship with our Aboriginal peoples. Aaron, do you think that they have a right strategy in this section to try and do that?
This is how many governments now have tried to make major progress in this file, and obviously we're still here trying to make progress. I don't doubt that they will come in with perhaps a more collaborative approach, be more willing to sit down for discussions and summits and first minister's meetings on this file, etc. Whether they can actually do everything they want to do and make a significant change and satisfy Aboriginal communities and the general population, that's a huge other question. Other people have pointed out, I can't remember which reporter it was, who pointed out that they have, in this throne speech, said that they will implement recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what is missing is the word all, as in all recommendations, which I believe is what the Liberal commitment seemed to be before
this. Which seemed reckless, frankly.
Yeah, indeed. So there's so much here. There is going to be an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. That's, they're going to go forward with that. But this is such a huge file and so wrought. And it'll be interesting to see how much of this they can deliver and how much progress can actually be made here.
Cormac, on this, the Indigenous file, this one thing I would mention is the worst disappointment for the Harper government in this was not being able to push through an education reform. They came close with Sean Atleo heading the Assembly First Nations, then the Assembly balked and split on this file. Trudeau has promised, I think it's $2.6 billion of memory serves over a number of years for Aboriginal education. There's not a lot of detail around that, but there is a dollar figure attached to it. To me, one of the most interesting things will be to see if he can get a clear breakthrough on that file that frustrated the previous government.
The last section that we're going to deal with is security and opportunity. This is one area where the opposition parties had some criticism for the government. What was the issue here, John?
I guess not mentioning ISIS was one of the issues. They wanted more clarity on who the sort of enemy is, I guess, is one of the things. Now, there is mention of fighting terrorism in the throne speech, but I guess it isn't as precise as the conservatives would have liked. That's how I heard it anyway, Cormac. Is that how you heard the criticism?
Yep, same here.
Yeah, it's sort of the way it's in. It's interesting, though. Like I thought most of this section, in fact, all this section, does again come straight out of the Liberal platform. But it made me think again about it, because one thing they talk about in here is renewing Canada's commitment to peacekeeping, which sounds a bit like boilerplate, except if you mean it. Peacekeeping is expensive, takes troops, and I would point out that the United States has just recently, not a big peacekeeping nation in a lot of ways, the U.S. in recent times, but the United States has just recently made renewing UN peacekeeping a big U.S. diplomatic priority. Samantha Power, the Obama's ambassador to the UN, has talked a lot about this. So I'll be interested to see if we see some meat on the bones of this, if it's not just, hey, we love the Blue Berets, and actually becomes, again, a focal point of Canadian missions abroad.
All right, thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate your thoughts. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, Maclean's Associate Editor Aaron Wherry, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Now, it's not just the Macleans panel weighing in. I actually caught up with former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, and along with a few other reporters, we asked him what he thought of the speech.
But it was a good to the point, you know, it was what was needed at this time. It's very rare that a government called Parliament within the month, and especially a few weeks before Christmas. So it was what was needed. You know, the speech of the throne is a plan for the future, but you have to deal with the daily problems too. And you, every day when you're in that job, there's something new coming.
So you're saying things can change.
Things change. I think that, you know, political leadership is creating a mood in the nation. You know, the government cannot do everything. The government can do no more than its best. But if you create the proper mood, people feel good. And when you feel good, you go out and spend your money. If you feel threatened and obsessed and that everything is dark, you hide home and put your money under the bed. It's not the way that the economy functions. So if you... Sunny days, he said. Sunny days are very good in life.
So do you think that this optimism will help with the economic issues that the government now
faces? I believe in that very much. You know, as I just said, the government cannot solve everything. But if you feel good, you know, if you feel I can, you elected me to fix it. So don't worry, I'll fix it. If you create that atmosphere, people feel good. When you feel good, you go out, invite her for a dinner, and all that jazz, and, you know, and you spend your money. So buy a new bicycle, whatnot, and the economy function.
How realistic do you think it is that they can get all these things done that they promised today in the next 4 years?
He will do his best. You know, I think that most of what I heard is doable. But sometimes you want to do something, and you realize you cannot do it. It happened to everybody on a daily basis. So there is no problem at a moment like that to say, I cannot do it. It's too bad.
What do you think the biggest challenge is for this new government?
To be good and to make the people feel good. That is a challenge. To create the mood in the nation, it's what make governments good.
That was the always colorful former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. Remember, for complete coverage of the throne speech, head to Macleans.ca, where we have several stories breaking down the marching orders for the Liberal government.
Still to come on the show, we speak with Government House Leader Dominic LeBlanc about the state of the House, we take a look at the Paris Climate Change Summit with Macleans senior writer Laura Payton, and we hear from the former Speaker of the House of Commons, Andrew Scheer.
Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Macleans Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we discuss the roadblocks on the route to a climate change deal in Paris, and the former Speaker of the House gives the new Speaker some key advice. But first...
The first session of Justin Trudeau's new government prompted a lot of talk of change, much of it about the tone in the House of Commons itself. There was even talk of banning heckling and outlawing clapping. Beyond adjusting the level of partisanship, the throne speech promised stronger House committees and more free votes. To get a sense of what's really going to change, Macleans Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down with Dominic LeBlanc, the Prime Minister's lifelong friend and now his key lieutenant on the Hill as government House leader.
LeBlanc reminisced a bit about growing up as the son of an MP and roaming the halls of Parliament with Trudeau, but Geddes starts out by asking him about that throne speech promise of a new era.
Broadly speaking, how should Canadians hear that? When they hear their voices getting stronger, what does that actually mean?
They should understand, or they should believe, that we want a less partisan House of Commons. We don't want government members standing up and reading talking points that they didn't write themselves and that somebody ordered them to go in and read. We want MPs to be able to stand up from all sides of the House, including the independents, by the way. Mm-hmm. We want them to be able to stand up and speak on behalf of their constituencies.
So if an MP in your caucus or your direct says something that's a little offside from the message of the day, you're not, and or other officers of the party in the House are not going to come down on the guy's head.
No, we don't see that as somehow a crisis or a fiasco. We see that as a strength. Like anything else, who was the famous British, was it a British judge or Lord Denning, who said that, you know, freedom of speech doesn't mean you can shout fire in a crowded movie cinema,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Obviously, the Prime Minister has said matters that were core commitments of our election platform. Obviously, matters of confidence, the budget and so on in the House of Commons. And issues or votes that go to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms are matters that we want people to share a common view and a common position. But expressing the views of his or her constituents or asking tough questions of ministers or amending government legislation in committees,
that's okay.
We see that as a strength.
Could I ask, can you give me one example of the sort of case where you might have a free vote now that there wouldn't have been a free vote in previous eras or maybe the most recent era in the House? Like, what's a type of issue that you'd say free vote's okay?
Well, some of the criminal law amendments that the previous Conservative government brought in, if ultimately the Minister of Justice comes into the House with bills that would deal with law reform or so on. In our view, those would be areas where members of Parliament should speak on behalf of their constituents, make amendments, and ultimately some of them decide not to support them. The challenge is, from our perspective, what it means is not that people lie around waiting to vote against the government bills. It means that ministers have to work with their colleagues to earn their support for legislative measures.
The Senate process that you announced this week, it's been a couple of days now. What's your judgment of how that's going over? Anything you've heard in the critique on that worries you? Anything you've heard that surprised you?
No, I wasn't surprised by what I heard, including from some provincial governments that have well-known views on the Senate. I respect that, and we expect it, and we'll work with and around that. That doesn't bother us. The proof will be in the pudding, however.
Quality of senators you get? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, the proof will be, I think, the proof points we see as once the advisory committee is appointed, Canadians will see in the case of the federal representatives three nonpartisan, credible, distinguished persons who I think will be beyond reproach in terms of their ability to fulfill this role. We hope and believe that the provincial representatives, the two sort of swing seats, if you want, or ad hoc seats, depending on the vacancies we're purporting to fill, those will be equally credible people. And ultimately, the Prime Minister will certainly, outside the transitional process designed to allow us to appoint five senators, hopefully by the end of January, early February, but early in 2016, the longer process for the remainder of 2016 that will fill the other vacancies, tens of thousands of people, presumably, will be referred to this panel, and there will be, we think, you know, a huge number of very qualified people, and five suggestions, recommendations, will go to the Prime Minister for each seat. So when the Prime Minister appoints at the end of January, early February, I think the proof will be that these are outstanding Canadians who were measured against the criteria, the public criteria that we put out, and provincial governments or provinces, if it's not the government, because in the case of a government that doesn't want to recommend two people to the advisory board, we will find two people from that province.
You won't worry about the fact that the province doesn't want to participate?
Well, the provinces, unfortunately, constitutionally, don't have a veto on the Prime Minister filling Senate vacancies from their province.
The talk of whether heckling and clapping are good things or bad things, or there's good heckling sometimes, but often bad heckling. There's clapping that's appropriate, but clapping, it shouldn't be all the time. What is your view on that? Is there a way to talk about the noise in the House? See, I like clever heckling, and I think occasionally the clapping is just a genuine response to a good point that's been made. How do you make rules around those things?
I would agree with what you said in the sense that there is clapping, which is genuine enthusiasm or support for a colleague or a particular opinion. That feels different sitting in the room than this robotic clapping because colleague X got up and made an intervention. That, to me, is less compelling. Heckling, you're right. Heckling, I mean, you can joke with your colleagues across the aisle and have sort of a pleasant exchange and laugh at yourself. A funny comment or a...
Even a pointed comment if it's clever, right?
Most yeah, and if it's not seen as... Mean. I think it's the tone. You're right, John. I think what people don't like, it's the sort of aggressive, rather mean behavior that, in fairness, on all sides of the House has been a problem. So if people commit to you know, listening. It's hard to listen to a colleague if you're busy shouting at them while they're speaking.
I just saw some kids of one of your cabinet colleagues in the halls here, and it made me think that you were a kid in the halls here one time.
With Catherine's kids? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you have thoughts about that? Or do you think we'll be seeing more kids of... I know you've got some young families in your among your MPs. Mm. Do you like seeing kids around? Does it remind you of when you were a kid?
I do. It reminds me of when I used to walk up from high school, which was a few blocks from here, Lisgar Collegiate, where I went to high school, and my dad was a single parent when I was in grade 9, 10, and 11, and I'd walk up from school with my homework and do it on his fourth floor office. He had 418 North, so it was one of the offices. John Baird had that last time in the last parliament. I'd go sit in an office, do my homework, and then go for... In those days, the House sat in the evenings. It was an 8 to 10 sitting, so we'd have supper and then go home to our house in the Glebe at 10 o'clock. You want to talk about changing behavior or improving collegiality. People tend to be nicer to one another if your young kids are around. It does tend to put smiles on people's faces. It's a good thing. I have memories of being one floor above exactly where we, in this exact corner on the third floor, waiting with the Prime Minister and his brothers for our dads to finish an evening cabinet meeting. In those days, some of the meetings were in the evening. People are more sensitive to that now. Like, there won't be evening meetings unless there's some urgency. Like, and people now want to try and get home. And I'm working with the other House leaders. Like, for example, why is it that we vote at 6:30 on Monday nights instead of after question period when everybody's here at 3 o'clock? So if you're not in a committee or on House duty, you might go home at 4:30 or 5 o'clock and have dinner with your kids.
That was Government House Leader Dominic LeBlanc in conversation with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. There's much more to this interview, and John will be writing about his sit-down in the days ahead. So check back with mcleans.ca.
Still to come, we speak with senior writer Laura Payton about the difficulties of reaching a deal at the Paris Climate Change Conference, and the former Speaker of the House of Commons speaks about the challenges and risks facing his replacement.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine. Still to come on the show, the House of Commons has a new speaker, and we speak with his predecessor about the challenges and risks that come with the job. But first...
Week one is now over for the UN climate talks in Paris. Countries from around the world, including Canada, are negotiating a deal to limit their greenhouse gas emissions to try and stave off climate change.
McLean's senior writer Laura Payton attended the first week of the conference, and her stories are in the latest issue of McLean's, as well as on McLean's.ca. Payton has just returned to Canada and joins us now to tell us how the talks are going.
So Laura, you're just back from Paris and the COP21 conference. What's your sense of where things are at? How much progress do you think is actually being made?
That's actually a really good question, because there were moments this past week where they were actually going backwards. So as you know, everyone, all the negotiators for all the countries are meeting right now to set an agreement for 2020 to 2030 for all of the countries around the world to reduce their emissions, to hopefully not go over 2 degrees of warming over pre-industrial levels. So they've got this draft text, 54 pages, and there's a bunch of brackets in it for things that people haven't yet agreed to. And what they were supposed to be doing this week was eliminating as much bracketed text as possible. And at one point, Green Party leader Elizabeth May, who was watching the negotiation, said they were actually adding brackets onto the text. So it was not going very well. And, you know, officials are even admitting that, where people are kind of acknowledging that's what's happening. Now, that said, we're told that the side conversations, what they call spin-offs there, the spin-offs are going better. They're moving along a little bit, and Friday night was the deadline for when they would have a text ready for the environment ministers, who are going to be taking over or taking the lead next week. Environment Minister Catherine McKenna from Canada, she was back for the speech from the throne, but she's going to be back in Paris on Sunday and lending a hand along with the negotiating team that's already there.
What's your sense of what the main problem is here? What's sort of the real holdup?
It's sort of a really traditional problem in the world, which is rich versus poor. You've got all of the developed world that, you know,
has a really good income for the people in the country. And the thinking is that they were able to do that on the back of the Industrial Revolution and just on polluting. And so you've got all of these developing countries who might be getting there, might be further from getting there, but they don't want to limit their ability to grow. And they don't want to be at a disadvantage compared to, or any more than they already are compared to the developed world. And so that's one of the discussions that's going on. And wrapped up in that are a few sort of technical terms that the UN is throwing around, like differentiation. So different countries contributing different amounts or even receiving different amounts. Loss and damage, and that's the idea of the polluting from the developed countries, that they should have to be responsible for the loss and damage. And then you've got the U.S. saying, well, absolutely, we're open to loss and damage, but we are not open to liability and compensation, which is the idea that flows from it, which is that then the developed countries would have to pay money for it. And then you also build in these other issues where you've got one group of countries known as the G77 in China. And, you know, you've got some countries that are not doing too badly. A country like Singapore that might have been a lot poorer when the first COP meeting, right, this is COP21, back when the first COP happened, some of these countries might have been a lot poorer. And there's a big difference now between, like, India and, say, Afghanistan or Sudan and what they're capable of doing. And so all of these politics are wrapped up into these discussions, and it makes it quite challenging.
And so where does Canada fit into this? What's their position, and sort of where are they at this point?
Well, Canada... Environment Minister Catherine McKenna has said that Canada wants to be really ambitious. They want five-year reviews so that people can look at their targets and make the targets harder. And they also put $2.65 billion over 5 years on the table. That's quite a chunk of money, obviously. Some of the discussion even comes down to what the target should be. So Canada and a lot of developed countries talk about 2 degrees of warming, which they feel like that... the world can sustain that, but other countries, especially the low-lying small island nations that are most affected by climate change, they talk over and over about 1.5. And there are a number of different variations of those targets mentioned in the text, and so those things still have to be agreed on. And so here's Green Party leader Elizabeth May describing that discussion for me.
So key issues, the most significant really are what is the goal. Are we going to state the goal as we must avoid 1.5 degrees global average temperature increase? That's still possible here. You see it in the text. You could still stay below 1.5 or well below 2, or just say, or as far below 2 as possible. In other words, 2 degrees Celsius is not a goal. It must be avoided. And the bigger the margin by which we avoid 2 degrees, the greater the chances that we'll avoid really catastrophic impacts of climate change.
Because I've heard a lot of the island states talking about 1.5,
yeah.
Right?
1.5, if it is, it's not, even 1.5 isn't a safe zone. You can see the kind of climate disasters that we're already experiencing with slightly less than 1 degree currently experienced.
So what's Canada's position here? Where are we at these negotiations?
Well, Canada came in with a lot of hope. We've kind of talked about that before. The Liberal government has given, and their position on science and climate policy has given them a lot more credibility in the world, and people are talking about that. And you can see it at the conference and even at the negotiating table. The contributions are a little bit different from how they used to be. So Canada has talked about being ambitious. Catherine McKenna has used that word a lot. They want five-year reviews where countries will take another look at their pledges and see if they can do better. And they want people to be accountable for it. Now, that doesn't mean that they are legally bound to the targets they put out, but it does mean that they have to be responsible. They have to report and monitor their emissions. And Canada's also put a big chunk of money on the table, $2.65 billion over 5 years, and that's for poor countries to adapt to climate change. But at the same time, they've gone into the meeting with the same targets as the Conservative Party, the previous Conservative government. And so you know, there's questions about how much more ambitious Canada can be, especially because there's sort of debate over how likely it is that Canada can hit the 2030 targets, even with some of the new commitments that the provinces have made to lower emissions. So the Liberals have promised that they're going to have a framework. It's in their platform. And they've tied it to this meeting with the premiers. They've promised to have 90 days after the Paris talks are over. Now, it's not clear if that is when we will get their exact plan. And it's not clear, you know, whether that plan is going to include new targets. And so when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in Paris on Monday for the talks to help kick them off, he was asked a number of times variations on those questions, four or five times, and four or five times he gave no specifics. But he did have an interesting answer referring to stuff that was laid out in the platform, but it does get into some specifics. So let's take a listen to what he said.
One of the things that that has been very clear is that we got elected with a strong desire by Canadians to take real action on climate change, and we put forward an ambitious plan to start addressing the lack of environmental action and leadership that Canada has shown over the past few years. So we have concrete steps already mapped out that we intend to do, whether it be green infrastructure investments or a low carbon economy trust or initiatives around creating energy efficiencies and upgrading our competitiveness in natural resources and investing in clean tech innovation. There's a broad range of things that we are doing and that we are going to continue to do. But we are also going to work with our provincial partners and work with big cities who have been leaders in many different ways on looking at reducing carbon emissions as well across Canada to ensure that we have a broad solution that meets the demands that Canadians are putting on us to develop an economy that doesn't benefit despite the environment, but in concordance and even in harmony with strong environmental protections. It's what Canadians expect, and it's what we're going to deliver.
So, Laura, at the risk of putting you on the spot, how do you think this is all going to work out? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, I have to admit, it's my first time at talks like this, and I don't know to what extent this is completely normal. It certainly seems normal for the UN, where you take it, it's consensus-based, and so you have to get everyone to agree, and that's why sometimes the language gets quite watered down. And, you know, you've got countries like Saudi Arabia who are interjecting into the conversation maybe less helpfully than some of the other countries. At the same time, you've got countries who, you know, they're not working at cross purposes. It's more that they're trying to represent their countries well. So when you have the, you know, the G77 plus China, for example, they were incensed that some of the developed countries want to put in a clause about it's basically being able to pay what you have determined you're able to pay into helping other countries. And their point of view is that all of them need help, including China and India, because they are all still developing. They all have elements that are very, very poor, people who are very poor living in their countries. But it's going to be interesting to see whether the developed countries are willing to put up more money, because they've certainly already devoted some. And, you know, everyone, it's hard to get money from anyone these days.
Was there any sense did you get any sense on the ground that people were worried that there wouldn't be a deal? I've read sort of thoughts here that people have said, well, you know, there's all sorts of problems, and then in the last sort of 48 hours they solve these things. Was there that feeling, or was there real fear that this isn't going to come together?
I didn't get a sense of any real fear. What I was told was from a few people was, well, no, there's going to be a deal. It's just whether or not it's going to be the strong, ambitious deal that we want. People were talking a bit about the change of pace. So the kind of apocryphal, example was in 2009 in Copenhagen, which was the last time that they really were looking at setting 5 years of targets. And all of the leaders, including Obama, who was very fresh at that point, they showed up on the last few days, and people felt that it had thrown off the negotiations and maybe and made them backtrack. And they kind of scrambled to, in the end, to get together and get a deal that was not what they had wanted. And so in Paris, all of the leaders showed up on the first day. They had all kinds of great momentum going in because all of the countries, or most of them, had presented the targets they thought they could hit. And China and the U.S. have reached a bilateral agreement on what they can do, and they're responsible for like half the world's emissions. And so people were really, really optimistic. And that... you know, people are talking about how the leaders showing up early has somehow thrown all of that off because they're not used to it happening that way. And they feel like somehow it sort of torpedoed the momentum they had from everyone tabling their targets early. But at the same time, I didn't hear anyone refer to the idea that there might not be a deal. So it's going to be maybe a question of how ambitious the deal is and how often we're revisiting it.
One of the discussion back on this side of the Atlantic has sort of split on this idea of whether this is going to be real progress or not. I think based mostly on the idea that there aren't going to be mandatory targets. Did you get a sense there of whether people felt they were making real progress, that they were on the verge of really accomplishing something here?
That's harder to answer. People are certainly hopeful that they're going to do that, and that is part of why they want to come back in 5 years so that they can set stronger targets. But, you know, it's tough with the UN. I mean, it can get so bureaucratic. Like, even we're talking about targets, as you know, but the word that they're using at the conference is they're using acronym INDCs, which means Intended Nationally Determined Contributions. And that's because targets is too binding. So instead, they're talking about the contributions that each country feels that they might be able to make. And even now, you know, they were debating the transition to another acronym that would mean something even more different. And so it's, you know, it's a complicated world, and I think they'll get a deal, but whether or not it's going to be enough, it hasn't been yet.
That was Maclean's senior writer Laura Payton discussing the Paris climate change negotiations. Payton has written extensively about the talks. Once again, to see her work, pick up the latest issue of Maclean's or head to macleans.ca.
Coming up after the break, the old Speaker of the House of Commons has some advice for the new one. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
The House of Commons has a new speaker.
Halifax West.
Liberal MP Jeff Regan was elected by his colleagues to take over as the so-called referee of the House. He beat out three other candidates for the position. The 56-year-old longtime MP has politics in his blood. His father was a former federal minister and is a former premier of Nova Scotia. Regan becomes the first speaker from Atlantic Canada in nearly 100 years.
In his acceptance speech, Regan spoke about how he plans to handle the House.
My role as your speaker is to be fair. And I want to assure you, I intend to be fair and I intend to be firm. I will not tolerate heckling. We don't need it. Not tolerant. And we're not going to, and we will not tolerate unparliamentary conduct.
In congratulating Regan, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau discussed how he wants to change the way the House of Commons operates.
Moving forward, I know that it's important that we have constructive debates in this place on issues that Canadians have told us matter to them. We will work hard to promote more openness across government. We will give Canadians and all members a voice in Ottawa and in this chamber. This also means greater independence of committees, reforming question period, and more free votes.
And the Leader of the Opposition, Rona Ambrose, made a commitment to bring a new tone to the working relationship in the House, but also issued a warning to Trudeau.
You can count on our cooperation at all times and in all situations. And on that same note, I would like to say to the Prime Minister, through you, Mr. Speaker, that when it's in the best interests of Canadians, he too can count on our cooperation and support. And, Mr. Speaker, if the Prime Minister is wondering what I'm prepared to do when he does not act in the best interests of Canadians, to him I say, just watch me.
The first test of this new relationship and for the new speaker comes Monday when we'll see the first question period for the new government.
To speak more about the selection of Jeff Regan as speaker and the challenges he may face, I was able to catch up with the now former speaker, Andrew Scheer. He decided not to run again so he could take on the role of Conservative House Leader. I was able to speak with him briefly in the foyer of the House of Commons not long after Regan was elected.
So I guess, first of all, what are your thoughts on Jeff Regan getting the position?
Oh, I'm very happy for him. I congratulate him. I know he'll do well. He's got a long-term member of the House, and I think he's displayed during the Speaker campaign an appreciation for the traditions of the House, understanding of what the Speaker's role is. So very happy to see him take the chair.
Is that what goes into the campaign, just basically trying to show other MPs your knowledge of the parliamentary system and how it works and how to handle the House?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that members want to know that the Speaker has, the fundamentals at their fingertips, that they don't have to pause every few minutes and check the rule book type of thing, but also understand the sense of the House and the Speaker's relationship. A lot of individual MPs will have unique areas of focus. They want to see the Speaker do this, the Speaker do that. And what I said to those members was, you know what, I'm the servant of the entire House. I'm not there to just, preside a certain way just because that's what you like to see. And in general, I think that's what Jeff did. I think he was very good at conveying that understanding of the House.
How is it different from the time that you were elected Speaker to this one? Because they changed the rules on everything, correct?
They changed the rules on how you vote. So I think there were fewer hospitality suites. When I ran, we had large gaps throughout the day as they counted the different ballots. This time, there was just the one ballot. So the whole day last time was very different. Some of it had a bit of a feel like a convention. When one member dropped off the ballot, the remaining candidates went and tried to, convince their supporters to come onto their side. Today it was kind of very simple. It didn't have any of that, so it was very different.
So what are your tips, your advice for Jeff Regan as he takes over this new role?
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting with him and kind of go through a little transition document to the ongoing files. But in general, not to take anything too personally, when you're in the Speaker's chair, you will look up sometimes and people that were your friends or are your friends are losing their marbles at you because you've allowed someone to go over time by 3 or 4 seconds, and they scream and yell, and it used to really bother me. I would leave the chamber thinking, oh my gosh, so-and-so is just yelling at me, and what can I do? And then I realized that I thought about it much longer than they did. As soon as they leave, they've already forgotten about it. And it's part of the frustration that comes out of not always being able to speak because time is so limited, and those emotions kind of spill out onto the floor, and the Speaker just has to remain above that and just let all that wash off his back.
And if you don't mind, just one more question on this. Trudeau was talking about changing the way things are done inside the House. Do you have any thoughts on that yourself?
I think anything we do, we should really take our time to look at. It's easy to look at something the Americans do or something the British do and say, hey, we could just bring that over here. But our House is different. It's evolved over time differently. I'd like to see what their proposals are. Some of what I've heard is interesting, but fundamentally, our job is to hold the government to account. We want to make sure that they're not going to change the rules on that to make it easier on the government. We want to make sure that we still have opportunities to question ministers as things develop. If something breaks in the morning, we'd like to know that the minister's going to be there in the afternoon for question period. So we'll see what they come forward, but in our desire, whatever the proposals are, we need to take our time. And most importantly, we'd like to see all party support for whatever is proposed. We don't want to see them use their majority to just change something for their benefit.
But what are the risks if there are going to be changes to the way the House is run?
Well, we have to see what the proposal is first. And that's where the study comes in. The Procedure and House Affairs study could look at an idea, a proposal, and ask those questions. Say, okay, what are we not thinking? Let's bring in parliamentary experts. Let's bring in clerks from provincial parliaments. Let's bring in clerks from the United Kingdom. Let's bring in former parliamentarians and get all that out. I think it's premature to try to guess what some of it might be or what the risks might be until we actually see what they're going to come up with.
That was the now former Speaker of the House of Commons, Andrew Scheer, speaking about the new Speaker, Jeff Regan, who was elected to the position on Thursday.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.